Welcome to the Revenue Lounge, a podcast for revenue operations professionals who want to understand the various facets of this important go-to-market function. In each episode, the team at Nectar interviews revenue warriors on how they are reimagining revenue operations in creative and disruptive ways, and what are their secrets to building a scalable and predictable revenue engine. Let's get started.
Retention is no longer just about the renewal process. It's about creating a seamless, proactive strategy that starts from the very first interaction and extends throughout the entire customer journey. Today, we'll explore how to align your customer success efforts with the reasons customers chose your product in the first place, ensuring that every digital touchpoint reinforces their decision. We'll also discuss the critical role of data and business intelligence in crafting a strategy that not only retains customers, but drives growth and enhances the overall customer experience. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Revenue Lounge podcast. I am your host, Randy Likas, and joining me today is Sam Slevin. Sam is the Global Senior Vice President of Customer Success at AlphaSense. His expertise lies in delivering dynamic revenue growth for both emerging and established companies through account management and client-facing capabilities. For those of you who'd like to learn more from Sam, he also teaches a class in the foundations of customer success at Pavilion. Hey, Sam, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Randy. Super excited to chat.
Yeah, me as well. So Sam, for those on the audience that might not know who AlphaSense is, give us a little bit of a background in terms of what the company does, and then maybe a little bit more about your background and your role.
Yeah, so AlphaSense is, and I feel a little silly saying this because everyone says this now, an AI platform that helps essentially remove uncertainty when making really important decisions. And so I joke about being silly about saying AI because everyone has like a .AI at the end of their name or whatever the case may be. We've been a true native AI company for the last 10 years and have actually been in a really exciting position to catch the tailwinds of this AI revolution. And so what I mean by what AlphaSense does is we have hundreds of millions of super high valuable content. So things like expert transcript calls or broker research or earnings calls or 10Ks and Qs or PubMed and filings. And we host it all, tag it, have company name recognition around it. And then from there, you can ask questions and query to get the information that you need. So we work with hedge funds, asset managers, Fortune 1000, Fortune 5000 companies, investor relations that are trying to make better decisions, whether it's in preparation for earnings or if you're talking to IR or strategic competitive intelligence or generate alpha on returns for a hedge fund or account asset manager.
That's a great background. Thanks, Sam. And I think what's really interesting is as I was doing some of my desktop research, I think y'all have 4,000, this was probably a little dated by now, enterprise customers. About majority of those are the S&P 500. I also read in an article that Jack had put out back in April where he's like, we're at basically doubled revenue in 2 years, right? Or, you know, hit the $200 million in ACV. So it's a really rapidly growing business, especially what we've experienced over the past couple of years. Made a big acquisition recently, and it's sort of a speed right now that in terms of growing the business, which I think is pretty exciting. Can you talk a little bit about, when you think about your function, the global customer success, how do you organize your team? I would like to start asking a little bit more about the different roles that you might have that sort of roll up into you.
Yeah, so I think when you say customer success, it's one of those things that means a million different things at a million different places. And so at AlphaSense, my remit is really, I think about it by jobs to be done. So there is a post-sales, which is pretty standard. So you can think about account management or like a customer success layer. So you think about, we have these product specialists that we work together that are deep product experts that pair up really nicely with the account management team to drive usage, adoption, engagement. You have the account management organization that is a commercial organization, but really thinks about the customer and everything that they're doing. And then we work together with the sales team to grow. So the AM will source a lot of pipeline because we're a user-based model and we're delivering so much value that we may say, who else on your team should we be working with? Let me introduce you to my colleague. And so that's one aspect of what we do and how we're focused. Post-sales, and that's a global organization. We have people in Singapore, London, spread out throughout the continental US as well. And then we have a support organization. So you can think about that's pretty basic as handling chats, as well as email support, as well as internal support. Hey, I need to get this account set up, or can you handle help me with X, Y, or Z? It's like kind of an internal ticketing system that we can manage. And that's also global 24/5 today. We're going to go up to 24/7 over the next 12 months. And then we have a pre-sales team, which doesn't normally sit, I think, in customer success. And so that can be working with most of our customers test before they invest. And it actually is really good for sales and account management alignment and the handoff process, because I have a team that's involved in that aspect as well.
So the AM team that is involved with sourcing a lot of pipeline, at a certain point, they partner up with the AE. Who actually owns that? Is there variable comp tied to the AM as far as like closing the deal, or are they sourced gold on just pipeline sourcing?
Yeah, so the AMs are gold on a growth goal that they have to work together with their AE to close. They don't have a commission structure or something like that. It's a bonus tied to that. Then they have a gross renewal rate, which is one of the more critical functions. And then we have a discretionary component that is like those source pipeline and like the things that we believe lead to the outcomes over the course of the year.
Got it. Okay. And then how about the actual renewal itself? Who owns the renewal?
So the AMs own the renewal, but when there's growth opportunity, which oftentimes there is because we've added products, you are, you know, increasing the price like that. That's done in tandem.
Yeah. Great. Really helpful. So Sam, we're what, late September now. And for most companies, it's planning season, right? So they've either just started it or they're about to start it. And they're thinking about how do we balance the strategic direction of my function with the operational excellence and the need to scale efficiently. And I saw a post that you had shared a while back, which is your love-loathe relationship with annual planning. And so would love to understand, how do you think about that as you look at what's happening in the market right now, what's happening with your customers, and balancing that with your needs for next year?
Yeah, I'm right back into that moment of the love-loathe. And I joke, I have a newborn, but nothing keeps me up more at night than thinking about 2025 planning and all the different possibilities and ways and that we can go. So specifically on the question of like, how do I balance what we need to do today versus, you know, it changes every year. So usually there's some sort set of growth goals and parameters on costs that we need to set. And what's so exciting is it's like a blank canvas, essentially, where you can, in theory, do anything that you want differently. And then you have to manage that against change management and how would you roll that out and the impact to the organization. You mentioned we just acquired Tegas for almost $1 billion. So that's a really exciting organization and a ton of talent that I've been a part of. This is my fourth acquisition at AlphaSense. And so because we're in the fintech space that is actually servicing, that's not like a payment processing company, that's like actually servicing knowledge workers, it's a huge opportunity for talent that knows how to service these types of customers. So that's a big piece of the planning this year, is like how we integrate Tegas and Tegas customers and AlphaSense and part of the migration plans all together while decreasing burn and increasing growth.
Yeah. So with Tegas, I see the headlines usually as like 4,000 enterprise customers, but I'm sure you serve mid-market, maybe even some SMB customers as well. With Tegas coming on board, how many customers are you looking at now globally?
Many more. I don't know what is public or what I can share in that kind of acquisition. So I don't want to share anything that's proprietary. But one of the things that's really exciting is so many of our customers actually had overlap. And right. So they would, Tegas is a content set, so an expert transcript library provider. They are the largest. We also did that. And so we really became 1 + 1 = 3. They also had acquired this company called Catalyst and BAMSEC. And so they had this whole platform that they're delivering a lot of value to their customers on. And we have a lot of the same customers. Maybe it's the same user that's using it for both, and now we can put it all together in one place. No. Or it's different users within the firm that are using it, because like a hedge fund, for example, a lot of they kind of operate as like their own little LLCs within the organization that has their own pool of capital under the bigger umbrella. So the left hand might not be talking to the right hand. And so they might have a very different tool set and stack.
Interesting. Cool. So Sam, you've emphasized that a strong renewal process begins with the very first customer interaction. And I think that's great, right? And I want to spend some time sort of digging in on that. Oftentimes, what we see is there's this gap in what the AE knows from their sales process or maybe landing that first deal, like buying committee members, influencers, you know, politics, that type of thing, that either never makes it to the CRM, it's stuck in their head, or it's locked up inside of different email threads and meetings and things like that. And so there's this, it's just stuck or buried. And what happens is the deal gets really close to signing, or it's just after signature and we schedule this meeting with the CS team and we're like, okay, I'm going to do this transition meeting with you. And it's just this big dump, right? But a lot of that is missed. And so can you elaborate a little bit more in terms of how the AE and the AM handoff works from the first touch point to make sure that the initial onboarding is setting the stage for long-term success and retention?
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, we have an ideal state, and that's what we always drive towards in the playbooks that we are doing there. But for me, I focus so much on the first interaction because that is, one, completely within your control. There are so many things that happen over the course of a life cycle that are not in your control. And so starting with the first interaction, what controlling what you can control is so important. I just think about, I have a ton of empathy for the buyer who their general life cycle is, maybe they're getting pinged a bunch of times by SDRs, a million email campaigns, finally get on a demo with an AE. Now, the way that we work is in a convert, someone on the pre-sales team is helping work with them and generate value and show them wow moments. Then the AE is coming back. Then they get the AM. And I don't think there's any worse experience for a customer at that point to say like, so tell me about yourself. It's like, it has to be, this is what I know. And this is how, where we can go from here. And so I think it starts with the way that our AEs sell is they put together a proposal, and it's understanding what are the goals and what are we trying to achieve. Because we have a trial process, before you put someone on trial, you need to have trial qualification and trial criteria. So what are the things that are gonna look like if we hit X, Y, and Z during this trial? How will that make you successful? And then we're going to move forward with a deal. And so to try and be as, you know, I just think about it all as building upon each other. So the sales team has that proposal, then that should be the first slide of our kickoff deck. And the kickoff deck should be like, this is what I heard is the reason that you bought. This is what you were trying to solve. These are your words. This is what you told the person. What do I have wrong here? So it's not like you're making them repeat. You're letting them fill in the details. So you're building upon. And then that's your criteria to make sure that is like your North, I call it your North Star in their words of like how we think about everything. So whatever their North Star is, then it's the AM's job to make that continue to come true and to prove over and over again that these are the things that they, the reasons they bought. And here is me demonstrating how that is happening through the usage, through the value stories, through the ROI of the partnership. Yep. And then you're doing something like a strategic business review, which again, I think is like overused and people do it quarterly, or it's like a check the box item. And it should be, you said, this is what you bought. This is what we agreed upon was success. Here's what I believe, how I'm delivering this or not. And I need to get this back on track. Mm-hmm. And here's where we're going to go from here and making sure that you have that. And if you've done that, and then there's obviously way more intermittent outreach, making sure you're adding, being a value added consultative partner throughout the partnership. Then come renewal time, it shouldn't be, are we going to renew? Because they bought, you confirmed why and what success looked like. You then had a checkpoint with them about what that looked like. And now we're talking about renewal, which is maybe how do we grow together, or where else should we be working, or based on these things that we saw and working together with the AE to build that momentum.
Yeah, I think that's fantastic. Let me just dig in on that trial piece you're talking about before, because I think most organizations use trials as the last resort, right? And so if I'm understanding you correctly, you guys build it into your process because it helps set up the success later on. Is that correct?
One of the things that AlphaSense does really, really well is we don't sell ahead of the roadmap. Mm-hmm. And so it's not this thing that maybe could happen if we deliver all these different areas. It's like, there's more that's coming and we'll definitely sell the future of what's happening. But here is what is happening today. And we use that as a process that, like at previous companies I've had to deal with, this is what the salesperson told me, and this was a promise that maybe did or didn't come true, and you're competing with roadmap preferences. We can say, you bought this thing based on what you said it was going to do, and here's how we achieve it. Now we know we're not done. It was a one-week trial or whatever the case may be that did that and qualified. But yes, that's one of the ways that we stay super hyper-aligned.
Yeah, I think that's really powerful. So let's talk a little bit about the key milestones that you recommend tracking to ensure that North Star that we established at the beginning is aligning to the original intent and goals. As you mentioned, that ultimately is going to lead at the time of renewal, like the desired outcomes you want, like renewal at a minimum, but expansion opportunities as well. So I guess the question is, how do you track that you're aligning to that each step of the way?
Yeah, well, first, I think it's obviously starts with what we talked about, really tight AM, AE, handoff, collaboration, coordination, not making sure that the person has to repeat themselves over and over again. Mm-hmm. Then we talked about onboarding, and not, I think a lot of organizations talk about onboarding as a call, and we think about it as an experience. So what are the milestones within onboarding that you are hitting? And I think this is where you want to make sure there's gut feel and anecdote, but also data. Like, you need to be working with your BI team on what are the key components that make them stickier, that make them more likely to stay with you than not. And that's how you should be aligning your entire, you know, this is successfully done out of onboarding. It should be at some sort of time constraint, as well as the individual components, features, value stories, et cetera, whatever makes sense for you as an organization that yep. happens. Then they move out of that. And then there's like, all right, now what does true adoption look like? Is that a build upon? Are there new things or features that should be done? 10, 15 years ago, I would hear Salesforce knows that you create two dashboards, you'll never leave. And Salesforce is obviously an incredible SaaS business and ones that we all aspire to be in the size and scale. But like, that's what I think about is like, what are the things that if they do, they will stay here and be more likely to adopt and go deeper into the product, because that ultimately tends to be value derived. And I think about two things when we're getting started with any type of customer. One, start with the end in mind. Let's assume that they are going to cancel in 365 days. And let's assume that is the status quo. And how do we do everything we can that if they get there, we're like, no, you said this was your North Star. This is what we did. This is how we delivered. And this is how we've checked in the entire time. And so starting with the end in mind and working backwards from that is absolutely critical.
Yeah, that is so refreshing to hear. It's really important, I think, to hold not just yourselves accountable, but hold the clients accountable to what we talked about at the beginning. So when you land, I know there's probably several different buying committees that you could land with, right? Corporate strategy, market intelligence, business development, M&A, IR, so on and so forth. And sometimes you might land wall to wall, but my guess is you probably land with a function or two and then expand from there. Do you build that sort of expansion plan into the way in which you're delivering? Or are you really just focused on what they've purchased and how we deliver value against that?
I think that's one of the reasons that we keep the AE and AMs co-owning these, because it is such a land and expand strategy, and why we work together, but almost separate, where the AEs are going to hunt into different divisions and groups with under the, we've got the MSA signed. So now we can, that which is a really, you know, hard process. And so you get that part done, and then we can figure out what are the order forms that we add on. So that makes it a little bit smoother. But the way I see our job to be done is like, if that person says, hey, this, you know, sales rep is calling me from AlphaSense, like, you use that, what do you think? They're like, oh my God, I love it. I was actually going to tell you that we should be using it, because that often is what happens really quickly. People get pinged from a salesperson. They quickly look at that person on LinkedIn and then see if there's connections or whatever the case may be. And then they're like trying to figure out if they're talking to each other. In the best case scenario, and what we try and guide the AMs and AEs to do is that deliver, like, just be great. I think I said two things before and I only talked about one. The second is that we live on value is greater than price. That is like, I just live there. And that is like the number one thing that we need to be doing, because, and making sure that we are like, I just have this value greater than price, and that the value has to be greater. And how are we living and breathing that? And if we are doing that, then we have the right to ask our customer that we built a good relationship, we've delivered X, Y, and Z for, hey, my AE is trying to get in touch with these four people. It seems like you're connected with them on LinkedIn. Can you make that introduction? I actually have an email for you. Would that be like really easy? Like, you just told me how much value you're adding. So I'm assuming you want to help your person. And that's such an easy way to, it's such a better way to get the meeting. So yeah. Yes.
100%. So we often hear that there's a challenge in success, which is the sales rep to get the initial land had identified their buying committee and the influencers, the economic buyer, so on and so forth. Then they land the deal. And then those people go turn it over to the people responsible for administering the contract. And it's hard to get them engaged again, right? So you're really focused on value, and that might make it easier to keep those folks engaged. But I'd love to hear, is that an experience that you see as well, where you're working not necessarily day to day or week to week or whatever it might be with the folks who have the power to expand or renew, but you're left with the people delegated to manage it? And if that's the case, how do you then make sure that you're able to ladder back up to those senior leaders at the right touch points?
Yeah, it's definitely a problem. I think, it starts with, like, why did that person buy at that moment, and what did they care about? And who is the decision maker? Who's the economic buyer? Who has the influence? And how are they measuring whether this is successful or not? And my belief is, when an AM or a customer success rep says to me, they won't answer me, I'm like, well, you obviously haven't delivered value to them and you don't care what they care about. The AE got a stranger to sign up for money. And so they've already put down money now. And so we need to make them effective in that route. And so it goes back to, why did they buy? What are the things that they care about? And if we're not delivering success on that in the first 90 days, that's a time where you send that message to them and say, hey, I'm a little concerned. Like, you bought for these three things. I don't think we've connected or done these things yet. And I'm concerned. Can we hop on the phone? And I have a couple of ideas on how we can fix this, but I need your help. And I think that's, a lot of people are scared to do that, but you need to, if you don't do it, again, you're at the end of 365 and they're going to cancel. It's not going to not cancel because you don't pay attention to it. It's good to call those things out and figure out why you're concerned if you don't have that buy-in, or what happened, or whatever the case may be. And in the meantime, you should be building a bottoms up case and asking, again, if you have a person who loves your account and loves what you're doing, you're delivering a ton of value, making their life happier, like, they'll give you a lay, oh yeah, this is political, this person didn't want it, but this person shoved it down their throat. Like, you can start to understand what's going on and how you actually can navigate that as best as possible.
Yeah. There's a trend that we're seeing in the market, which is, because it's so hard to land customers right now, everybody's doubling down on making sure that we can retain, right, and expand. And there's almost this movement of treating your renewal committee, if you will, similar to how you would do it in a brand new deal, where we're applying, like, MedPIC type of processes to identify, you know, decision makers and paperwork and everything sort of goes into MedPIC. Do you manage a similar way as far as making sure that we've got the right people involved throughout, or are there any criteria? I guess, ask a different way, what are the signals that you look for to make sure that you've got sound renewals coming in?
Yeah, I think the MedPIC and that piece is the very end of the process. And so I actually would go a step further and say that what a lot of customer success teams do, or now they're starting to, like, we need to be commercial, we need to treat this in the same rigor as a sales process, is, does your team have call quotas? Do you break down their annual retention number into a quarterly number, into a monthly number, into a weekly number, into a daily number? What are the activities that need to happen? That is what sales actually does. Then the MedPIC is a framework, when you want to use MedPIC or Challenger Sale, like, you'll put some methodology that is a process that makes sense for that. And I agree that's an important piece, but I think that you jump to the conclusion there and it's like, how do we pull this deal back, or whatever the case may be. For me, it's like, how often are we talking to the users? What is the value that's being derived? Are they engaging with a certain amount of users? What percentage of those for the day, week, month? Does your AM or customer success person know what a great day looks like, a great week, a great month? Do you have quarterly business reviews internally to hold the team accountable on what they said that they were going to do? And then, sure, wrap it in MedPIC, wrap it in Challenger Sale, wrap it in whatever methodology you want to. And I agree with that, and that's important. But I think what's often overlooked or not talked about enough is that is what you need to do with a customer success organization. Inputs leading to outputs.
And how do y'all measure that? Because that's a really good point. But as far as making sure that we're winning the day, right? Because if you win the day, you win the week, you win the month. How are you measuring how your team is winning the day?
Yeah, it starts, like, with high value calls. We work backwards from how many users they have, how many accounts they have, and what we think is a good delivery of the customer lifecycle. And there's a minimum amount of calls that they need to do. And then, again, we'll coach. It's not an SDR motion, just like blast people with calls. It's not like, how many dials do you make? It's how many, like, high value calls do you have? It's how many strategic business reviews do you have? What percentage of your users have you spoken to in a month? What percentage of users have you spoken to in a quarter? How many calls? Like, so we have a framework and we tweak them as the business grows and what we align. And then those lead to outputs. We believe if you're doing those things, which you 100% can control, it'll lead to source pipeline. It'll lead to better forecasting accuracy. And so we try and understand. I think about if we have a problem, is it we're not driving the top of the funnel enough, the activities that we can control, and then we need to work with the rep on those activities. Is it not the right email? Are you not being value oriented? Are you getting a bunch of people on the first call and they won't get on a second call with you? You haven't added value then. And so then we need to do coaching in that way. Or are you not even, is it an effort, like skill or will, and then figuring out how you coach and develop based on those things. And then for me, so those are things, and then we have a discretionary component of their comp that is tied to making sure that they hit those inputs so that there is a carrot and a stick. You can get 100% of your variable compensation if you do these things because we know or we believe that these are the outcome that generate positive outcomes. And then I have my managers give me a month to date. Like they walk me through their numbers. They look at them. They have to analyze them and give me a write-up of what they're seeing, feeling, thinking so that it's being inspected, measured, constantly thought about and talked about. And then another further point of reinforcement is we have a quarterly business review. So every single account manager presents to their manager and leadership team on here was what I did. Here's how I did on these key metrics, whether it's effort, input, source pipeline, my retention rate. Here's the strategies and tactics that I enabled. Now let's spend most of the time going forward. And what am I going to do on a go forward basis? And what can I hold you to? And then that becomes the beginning of their QBR the next time. So they have to own their numbers. And like, it's not just like at the end of the year, at the end of the like, you didn't get to your numbers. It's a measurement and impact. And then as part of the discretionary, each quarter, my managers will look at, here are the five dimensions that I said that we're measuring you on. You're above, below, or at, and here's a discretionary component as well. And then that gets sent to me as well. So I get to see those each quarter and understand what's going on.
Yeah, that's really well thought out process. I imagine that your team is probably looking at several different sets of data to determine health, right? And so there's probably product consumption data that they look at. Might go Salesforce, maybe a Gainsight or a similar CS type of tool. I'm curious, are they managed as all separate systems? Or have you guys built like a cloud data warehouse that sort of brings all these data points together and you're able to look at different data points side by side? How does the different telemetry work for your teams to help deliver value?
Yeah, so I think what a lot of people do is they jump in, and I've used kind of all the different customer success tools over the last 15 years or so. What a lot of people do is they're like, all right, we have a churn problem where we're trying to get efficient and let's justify a customer success tool to do this. And then it's like a year build. And then if you don't actually have the right, like kind of the precision that I just talked about to employ and what success looks like and have the right data points of what you're trying to drive to, then it just becomes another tool. So we use Catalyst now as a tool and it's a work in progress where it combines usage data and activity and revenue. So like a combination of Salesforce plus Tableau plus other data warehouse. Then I think a big one is Gong for us. Like from coaching and development and watching your own game tape. I don't know if I'm supposed to be plugging the tools that we use, but these are what we use. And I'm a huge Gong fan personally. And so we're using the customer success. And then there's still these things that we still need to do in Salesforce. And as we launched a V1 of Catalyst, V2, V3, V4 is going to be like taking all the disparate pieces of information and putting it under a slick UI, which is Catalyst for a customer success platform.
Does your team mostly live out of Catalyst as opposed to, say, Salesforce?
I would say up until we just launched Catalyst in the last 2 months to the team, and I've learned from failed launches in my past, so I'm hoping that this is a net positive. We're seeing great usage and adoption from the team so far. Eventually, we would like everything to live in Catalyst. There are still bespoke places that you can't get to because I don't want someone. But then you're never going to replace Tableau overall or a data visualization tool for like, you need to put together a super in-depth strategic business review on usage. You need to really get a very custom data pull that aligns to the story and value that you're working with. But like day-to-day, lack of usage, lack of XYZ content set, like those are the types of things that set off quick alarms and should be allowed to move really quickly and actionably.
Yeah. Let's transition the conversation a little bit and talk about this sort of movement to a digital customer success motion or model, where we've seen it work a couple of different ways, where you identify maybe a lower segment or less strategic clients that you want to move more digital touch points to, as opposed to like the white glove experience. Does a well-executed digital success strategy support both that lower segment as well as the enterprise? Or how do you think about digital as it plays in the overall success, customer success function?
Yeah, I think it, so that's what I love about it, is that it supports both, in my opinion. It's a very similar motion of a multi-thousand organization that you're supporting and a one-person shop, because you can't get to every single one of those people in a white glove support. So what are you doing? You're either doing train the trainer programs, or doing, you know, big group trainings or floor walks or things like that. But you need extra like air cover, and that's what it is. It's air cover. And then on the flip side of a smaller account, if you have a big book of business or a lot of accounts in your book of business, you're probably going to pay that small account a lot less attention and love. And through a digital experience, trigger-based usage, and the things, again, aligning to what are the things that drive value, make them happy and excited and stay long-term, you can do that. And so it'd be like with the strategic accounts, you want to customize it. If you're working with a Fortune 100 company, you want to think about the cohorts of people that you're working and take the baseline of the milestones and customize it and make it a little bit more white labeled for them. But like the bones and the infrastructure is generally the same.
Yeah. I had a conversation 3 months ago with one of our large customers, and it was with the guy, he was the Gainsight admin at his customer. And prior to that, he worked at some pretty large companies, but he actually spent 6 years in the professional services division of Gainsight. So he's like, I've probably touched 1,000 different instances of Gainsight over my career. And every single one of them has a contact hygiene or contact problem. And he said, and we got to solve that, especially as we roll out like a digital success program. We have to make sure that the data is clean so that we're not taking a shotgun approach and sending out messages to everybody, because that's a bad customer experience, right? So can you talk a little bit about like data hygiene, and how do you overcome some of those issues that you might have where the data that Catalyst pulls from is stale, dirty, outdated, whatever it might be?
Yeah, before we move people to digital touch, that is a extremely manual scrub. We don't do, that's like, you create a segmentation that you label as tech touch, but then you need to go through all these different check marks, because otherwise that's what I've experienced. You're like, this is what we say is tech touch, and let's just move them and go. And you want to iterate and make sure that you're doing things in the right way. So I think that's one piece. I don't think you get away from a human intervention in some level, shape, or form in terms of like pure digital touch. But I think if users leave, there has to be some sort of trigger that happens that fills that seat, or maybe it's through the SDRs that they're tracking that. There has to be some sort of feedback mechanism that if you no longer have someone there, unless you're comfortable with it just churning, because you factor that in and that's how you base your model. We don't do that. We want every customer to renew. And I've been at companies that have done digital as a, we absolutely, like our churn rate on this SMB business is so bad that we can't possibly serve it with a human. And so you're going to do things a little bit differently and a little bit quicker. For us, we don't really work with like true SMB because of the cohorts of customers that we work with, yeah. But maybe the smaller firms that we're working with, we believe we can deliver a better experience for them where it's based on the things that we think that they need to do. But it's, we do a lot of manual inspection before we put them into that program.
Yeah. So who owns that manual inspection? Is that like your team, or is it your RevOps team? It's a lot of work, right? It's a lot of like tedious work. So who owns that process?
Yeah, it starts with RevOps in terms of the segmentation, but then my team has done the manual. We're moving this over, and here's like the 6 check boxes that we need you to confirm. And ultimately, it's a good thing for the AM. Like, you can spend more time on.
Yeah.
And then it's, how do you create? Is it every week that you do it? Every month? Like, we're coming to a quarterly cadence where it's like every quarter we're going to look at who reaches this segment and how should we do it and what's the process for moving it on. And that becomes part of your operating cadence, like a QBR, a business review. You look at your own internal processes, like a customer lifecycle. But it's definitely a problem. I mean, our data is not clean.
Nobody's.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. So Looking ahead, what do you see as the next big shift in customer success, and what companies should do or prepare for that?
Yeah, so I think you said in my intro, I teach this customer success essentials at Pavilion. And one of the things I get nervous about, we are a true native AI company, is like, we don't use enough AI, I don't think, day in and day out. And so I polled the audience in my last group of, what percentage of you use AI in your like day-to-day or as part of your workflow in the customer success, sales, revenue world? And it was less than 5%. And so I feel like there's a lot of hype. It's like Klarna did this thing in their earnings call. And everyone's like, how did they do that? And they could reduce these different areas. So I think the answer is AI. I just haven't seen enough tool set on how you do that in the right way. And how do you do it? And again, it depends. If you're trying to completely cut costs at the expense of customer experience, because this cohort or segment is just a flag on your business and you need to like, it's such a negative, which I've been at companies in the past where it is. But the way that I think about it is, you know, when you get to a certain size and scale with your organization, you have to be really careful with anything that you're deploying and what that looks like. So it feels like the AI customization, I'm looking at these tools all the time. This idea of like, I saw some tool that you could teach it all your sales collateral. And so we were thinking about it as an enablement play where you could sit there as a rep and get the marbles out of your mouth and train them as a prospect through the gong calls that they listen to and do that. So like, I think there's a lot of increasing ramp time and maybe answering some of the level one support questions over time so that the human beings can be focused on the more value added work. And I've seen Einstein demo for Salesforce. I'm like, oh my God, if we could connect Tableau. And I just think we're a longer ways away from actually having value utility there other than using a ChatGPT, a Llama or Perplexity or any of these to like, did I have any typos in this email or make this email a little bit nicer? I'm coming across like to help me change my tone and wording.
Yeah.
So what else? I think we're a user-based model, but I am interested in if you play out the next 2 to 3 years on, and I feel like user-based over the Salesforce model has been, you know, what everyone tries to get to, and it aligns you with the customer as you grow with them. If AI does start to rip its way through all these organizations and it decreases the amount of heads that people need to hire because more work can be done, is there a new pricing model that tries to take over? You know, I know Snowflake used the user-based model, but they had this amazing run and now they're flatlining on Nets. I wonder on how you think about those things as well.
Yeah, it'd be really interesting to think about companies that have similar sort of consumption and do like a dynamic pricing based on that, using the AI for that would be interesting. And then I think I agree with you, like think about the use of AI. There's so much hype in the market right now. And I think the example that you talked about, which is if we can look at standard collateral or support, that's a good use case. But if you try to use it, any AI solution has to have good data as the basis, right? And I think we're still really far away from companies having good, clean data and go to market, especially to use those models. So
yeah, and this is one of the things that we encompass all the time. And my boss just wrote a post about this on LinkedIn where it's like this idea of buy versus build, where a lot of companies are like, we need to buy ChatGPT in this enterprise model. And how much are you spending on that? And then how many engineers are keeping that up to date to making sure that you are incorporating all the right things and then constantly training that? And so that's like a pitch for why you should be using AlphaSense instead of building yourself. But it's the same type of these things. It's hard enough to implement a customer success tool, which is just bad data. We were just talking about bad data in, bad data out. Imagine trying to train this thing that like could be giving you the wrong information and whatever the case may be. And so I'm positive that it will continue to improve. But that feels like it should be the right answer, but I feel like the tangible aspects are not there yet. And when I teach this class in 3 months, I hope that I'm like, yep, here's the three use cases I could use. But for now, I don't see it yet.
Yeah. All right, so last question before we transition to what we call the lightning round, which is a little bit more personal. What haven't I asked you about as it pertains to retention or growth that maybe I should have?
I think we talked a lot about sales AE handoff, but like one of the things at a larger organization that we didn't talk about is how do you get alignment at the organizational level between sales and account management and thinking through those things? I happen to be lucky. I'm working with an SVP of sales in the Americas that I worked with at my previous firm. And we just have such a deep trust and There's so many ways that you can, and it's Peter Kovacs, he's an amazing seller, and I've worked with him at my previous company. There's just so many ways that you can misinterpret something or have bad intent, or they think that person just cares about their goals and I just care about my goals. And so, and you come into that with a message of like, this is the sales guy and this is this account management leader and they don't care about growth and they're not commercially oriented and all those things. And so how do you get aligned? First, for me, I am aligned at ARR. ARR growth is incredibly important to me, whether it's retention, gross, net new sales. Then I have a net and then I have a gross in that order. And so I can say with him, I have a great relationship with my other, because we've worked together. I've never been more aligned at a level of leadership so that we know if things get escalated and misread at with our teams, it's very rare that we are going to disagree or, and I think it has to do with like compensation alignment. Alignment drives behavior. And so I'm a big believer on that piece. And that was one thing you didn't ask me about.
Okay. No, that's great. I have one more question based on what you just said around alignment. So what are the other functions in the organization that you have to have like similar alignment you have with sales? So as an example, product, right? You guys are hearing all the time. How do you, I guess it's a two-part question. How do you align with other functions besides sales? And then part two of that would be like, because of all the growth that you've all experienced over the past couple of years, there's a lot of change management that goes into this as well. And so can you maybe speak a little bit about the change management piece too?
Yeah. So one thing for me that was really pivotal for my career, I actually reported into a little, when I was a director of customer success at a previous company, I reported into the VP of product. And so tons of empathy on both ends. And I think if you're both walking into this being like, I don't want your job, you don't want my job, I feel bad for you, I like, you have the hardest job in the company, you have the hardest, like, I think that really on a human level, like you're like, if you come in with positive, good intent, whether it's, but I got to see firsthand the things that Henry Wong, who is the VP of product, dealt with day in and day out, and the way that he put together business cases and things like that. So I think like making sure you can speak their language and how they understand and have empathy on that. And I got a lucky kind of fortunate reporting structure for a year or two that like gave me that insight that I wouldn't have otherwise had. But like I've never been reported into the head of marketing, but like I try and understand at the end of the day, like what are the things that you are motivated by? What does success look like? If you're a new leader and we're growing really fast, like what are wins that you're looking for? How can I get you some of those early wins? And so that we can build a relationship. I think the other thing is I think a lot about what is my day-to-day cadence, week-to-week, month-to-month cadence. And I always make sure I do an exercise every probably half a year where I look at where I'm spending my time and should I be having more regular or less regular one-on-ones? Because what I try not to do, and I think a lot of people do this, is an issue comes up and you ping the person. And the only time they're hearing from you is you need something or you want something. And so what I try to do is have enough of a regular touch point with the, whether it's the CMO or the head of product or our CFO or RevOps, that I'm aggregating things and prioritizing them versus a Slack ping and a constant fire this and that. When I hate when people do that to me and it's so hard to like, it'll set me off or do I stop what I'm doing or I have these things. And so it's like, can I stack order them and prioritize them? And then once in a while, if I need something, it's not the only time I'm going to you. And so like, it's understanding those objectives. And then something like digital success, like that we talked about before, you can't do that without marketing, RevOps, BI. And yep. So you have to align on the why. Here's what we're trying to do. Who's going to own what? Here's the project plan. And how do we like hold each other accountable and making sure that happens? So I think like it's kicking off initiative, building a project plan, starting with the end in mind of where you want to get to, breaking down those milestones and giving people ownership so that they can go do their best work.
Yeah. I, what I loved about what you talked about is two things. Empathy, right? First of all, it's not about me, but understanding what they're up against as well. And then the second part is building those relationships, right? And having those relationships. So when things get hard, you have to have those hard conversations. You've got the relationship and sort of the trust to be able to do that. Let's transition over to the lightning round here. First question, what is the favorite part of your job?
I think it's got to be the people on my team, like working with people for a long time, watching them grow, take on challenges, deliver amazing outcomes. That is at the end of the day, because at this point, with the size of my team and what I do, 50 to 60% is personnel and people management. If you don't get joy from watching someone grow and develop and go on into their career and grow as a person. If you don't get joy from that, that's ultimately for me one of my biggest things.
Awesome. What about the flip side of that question? What is the one part of your job you don't like? Or I guess ask a different way, what's really hard about your job?
I think the flip side is on people. It's not people. Yeah. People are messy and there's things that are going on in their personal life and professional life. And when you get to a team size of north of 100 and hundreds of people, if something crazy, I do the math all the time. It's like, if one just absolutely horrific thing that you've never could imagine would happen happens to one person every 2 years, you'll be dealing with an issue every day, every week. That's the math on that. It's inevitable that those things will come up and those types of crazy situations that are tough in the moment. But the other thing, like, I just love the intellectual curiosity and challenging and figuring things out and moving forward is the other aspect of that.
Yeah. What's one piece of advice that you've gotten maybe early in your career that's really stuck with you and maybe share with the audience?
So one piece of advice that I've specifically been given is, it was actually from the head of product, and it was a combination of a few different things, but we were doing our review and I actually wrote a post. I was like a newer manager and we went from like garbage bags under our desk to one central garbage. And my team is complaining about this nonstop. And I have it as a line item in our one-on-one. And he's like, do you think this is a good use? We have 45 minutes once a week. Do you think this is a good use of time for you to take on or for you to even be bringing to me? And it was just such an aha moment. I thought that being a manager meant you fight for every single thing that your team needs. And that is it. That is so not what being a manager is. What being a manager is prioritizing and making sure that you are getting the most important things done at the right times.
Yeah. I'm smiling because I did read that post and I thought it was really funny because it's so true. All right, last question. Let's say there's a AM or a CSM maybe just starting their career a couple years in, but they would like to have your job someday. What advice would you give them?
Yeah, my advice is when you're 22, if you have anyone in your life that's good with money, they will say to you, just save a little bit now because the time value of money, and then by the time you're 65, and you don't really think about it, and you're like, I don't want to do that, and whatever the case can be. But I think about it as work ethic and putting in the time to learn and go above and beyond is that exact time value of money. You won't feel it today. You won't feel it tomorrow. I think it's a way to distinguish yourself. But all of a sudden, especially if you're at the right company, that should be a meritocracy of what do you produce and what are you doing, then by putting that work in now at 21, 22, 23, building those really strong, good habits, outworking, out hustling your peers and counterparts and colleagues, it just starts to add up and you start to separate yourselves and learn more and produce more and do more. And it becomes kind of this self-fulfilling prophecy, similar to the time value of money.
By doing that, it's building great habits that stick with you for life, right? Sam, this was really good conversation. I appreciate your time. I appreciate your insights. Have a great afternoon, and thanks everyone for listening.
Thanks.